This is a flat world, a coin world. We only have two choices. Does Trump continue having green lights, or can millions of stop signs become a red light he'll have no choice but to obey? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 30th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Lexis Ponce, Dan Raphael, Ken Jones. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Eric Galatas, Brian Bull, Edwin J. Vieira, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Sherry Meredith. Thank you for listening to our broadcast. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We're speaking with Laura Grimes from Oregon Arts Watch.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to talk about some of the latest stories from that publication. Welcome to the show, Laura.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you taking the time to talk us through what Arts Watch has been up to. The first story I want us to talk about today is called A Game Plan for Oregon Arts and Culture in Perilous Times. It's broken up into two parts. I would love to kind of talk through both of those halves. Maybe to start here, can you tell me about part one?
Subhashini Ganasan-Forbes she's the founder of New Expressive Works, and she's the chair of the board of the Oregon Arts Commission. She's been really instrumental in a lot of the work that has been shaping our cultural advocacy work and blueprints for change for a long time now. She's just a really wonderful advocate and ambassador for the arts. So in this story, Suba talks about what I'd like to emphasize is that culture is a history of who we are and reflects how we define ourselves. He talks about how it's a record of our history, but it is also the legacy that we have for future generations. She talks about how change is constant, how civilizations change through innovation, invasion, and interdependence, which directly creates cultural shifts. And so right now, as a lot of arts institutions are being defunded or on the brink of being defunded, we're encountering how museums, libraries, educational spaces, public radio, and arts institutions are under threat. She talks about how this is, a cultural shift and just how we could all be involved in helping to shape that. How do we meet the moment? So she talks about how culture sustains us all, but how it is also the responsibility of all of us. We're all a part of this, and how we all need to take responsibility, not just the culture bearers, because arts and culture is our shared legacy. We're all a partner in this. It affects all of us. And Suba quotes three leaders in the arts and culture community, Dana Whitelaw at the High Desert Museum, Adam Davis at Oregon Humanities. And she also quotes Carrie Hoops, who is the executive director of the James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation. And I thought this one quote by Carrie was important, so I'm just going to paraphrase it. She talks about how it's critical to recognize the role arts and culture play in sustaining our communities. The arts are an irreplaceable force for connection, innovation, and resilience. Basically, how the arts bring us all together and help us innovate and help us be sustainable and resilient. So then Suba offers a blueprint with several links and ways to be actively engaged with culture in some way. She encourages people to step into their shared responsibility and help define how they want to be remembered. What is that future going to look like, and how are people going to be engaged to help shape now, the present, to be able to leave a legacy for the future?
Could you give us some examples in that second half where she's writing about what are some of the possible actions that everyday folks might be able to take in terms of preserving and extending cultural creation and the legacy?
Yeah, she has it's a big long list, so people can sort of pick what their comfort level is. There are national level advocacy resources if people want to be more informed, like from the Americans for the Arts and the Federation of State Humanities Councils, Protect My Public Media, which I know listeners of KBOO might be interested in. She talks about state and regional advocacy resources, Oregon state cultural promoting entities, like our statewide cultural resources, like the Oregon Cultural Trust, the Oregon Arts Commission, Oregon Humanities, and the like. And then there are a lot of, you know, more local cultural institutions. There, every county has a commission, and they're often run by volunteers, and so those are ways. And then there are city alliances and commissions, and there are also several bills in front of the Oregon State Legislature that people can become familiar with and understand how those might affect our everyday lives. And so that, yeah, I thought that she, you know, she gave really kind of concrete places where people could go find information just to become more aware and to get involved. Oh, and some of it, I guess at the end, she talks about, you know, live performances, gallery openings, just ways that people can step into becoming an active participant in everyday life.
The other story from Oregon Arts Watch I wanted to ask you about is called Transgressors, Crossing Cultural Boundaries as Indigiqueer and Two-Spirit Artists. This one is by Beth Sorensen, and it's talking about this Indigenous queer exhibit that is making its way around the state right now. What can you tell me about this story?
This story by Beth Sorensen, it is about this exhibit that you mentioned is touring the state right now. And I'll give a little bit background, because it's a bigger project that has two parts. There was a previous exhibit that has a history to it, and then this is the more current exhibit. So this exhibit, Transgressors, was curated by Anthony Hudson and Felix Furby. It explores the Indigenous history, identity, and cultural revitalization through the work of nine multidisciplinary artists, includes like some big names like Jeffrey Gibson. Furby, who is Grand Ron and Chinook, is the linguist, Indigenous historical researcher, and carver. And Hudson, who is Grand Ron and Celeste, is a drag artist, theater performer, and visual artist. And the collaboration of the two, like I mentioned, led to these two exhibits. One was historical, and now this current one, which is a more contemporary exhibit that looks to the present and the future. So first I want to talk about the first exhibit that happened a few years ago to provide some context and the history that led to the current exhibit. So the 2023 exhibit was called My Father's Father's Sister, and it was at the Chachalu Cultural Museum in Grand Ronde. And it focused on Shimhun, who was a 19th century two-spirit of Kalapuya and Tualatin descent. Shimhun was a healer, and the exhibit explored the history of two-spirit and indigiqueer peoples in tribal communities. And it showed a light not just on Shimhun, who was the focus of it, but also artists who are currently working within the Grand Ronde tribe. Two-spirit is a contemporary indigenous term for people who are not limited to the Western male-female binary and who can encompass a wide range of gender and sexual orientations. Two-spirit people traditionally were spiritual leaders and healers in their tribal communities. So while My Father's Father's Sister looked to the past, this second part of this project, this current exhibit, like I mentioned, looks to the present and the future. So Transgressors was on view at Chachalu Cultural Museum in Grand Ronde, and now it will be moving to the University of Oregon's Museum of Natural and Cultural History, which opens May 15th, and then a smaller version of the exhibit will continue to tour throughout Oregon through 2026. And like I mentioned, the exhibit features nine national and international artists on view. It includes paintings, carving, sculpture, beadwork, and photography. So what I really wanted to talk about with this, and how I thought this was a good pairing with Suba's story, is that Furby, one of the curators, talks about how this exhibit considers who we are now, and it's informing what we want out of our future, what we want out of our present based on who we are and how we step into our present day. And so I'm just going to quote this interesting passage from Furby, who talks about how with this exhibit, we also want to reframe ourselves as future ancestors. What kind of ancestors do we want to be in the future? What kind of future do we want to build? He says, you know, we have the ability as part of a living culture, as part of a community that has a future, to also think about what we want out of that future and make decisions for it. I thought that was really interesting, make decisions for our future. And so Furby talks about how this exhibit was stepping into that role as full participants in our cultures. It's calling attention to the fact that one day all of these people will also be ancestors that people refer back to. So I thought this directly related to Suba's point in her story, that we have the opportunity now to live today and actively participate in our culture to shape our own story and decide what will be remembered, how will we be remembered. So that becomes our legacy and the story that's told in the future. So the present defines both the history and the future, and we have the opportunity now to actively participate and shape our future.
That's very beautiful, and I appreciate how you wove some of the takeaways from these stories together.
Yeah, it kind of actually caught me off guard when I was reading it, because you often think about history, and I thought it was fascinating how the present defines both the history and the future, but I guess I really hadn't thought before how you can make active choices now to decide what that future is going to be. How are you going to define your legacy and be remembered? And the fact that both these stories talked about actively participating and making those choices now.
If our listeners are interested in reading these pieces for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can find all of these stories and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I always like kind of trying to find ideas that help to make us think. And it's not just news, but it's about ideas and connections and how we shape ourselves. So I really appreciate that.
That was Laura Grimes, the executive director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest stories from her publication. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland Youth Philharmonic, America's longest-running youth orchestra, closes its 101st season this Sunday, May 4th, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The program, titled The Search for Beauty, includes Robert Schumann's Manfred Overture, Valerie Coleman's Tracing Visions, Ruth Gibbs' Symphony No. 2, Dmitri Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 2, and to top it all off, Yoda's theme by John Williams. To preview Sunday's concert, we're joined today by David Hattner, PYP's musical director, along with Hanson Barrett, the soloist on Shostakovich's Piano Concerto. David, the concert this Sunday is the last of the Schnitzer for PYP's historic 101st season. I remember last year you featured a dual piano version of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and also Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, which was the very first piece performed by the orchestra back in 1924. Do you try to do something special for every season closer?
Well, it's good to find music that celebrates the hard work that the students have done throughout the year. But I don't necessarily try to put the biggest, most important work on the final concert. The whole season is really a menu of pieces that should give the musician, especially if they're in the orchestra for 2 years, a fairly complete approach to what symphonic music is. It's hard within one season to cover all the different things that a student could run into. I try to have at least one big standard repertoire piece on each season. That was the Brahms Second Symphony on our last concert. And I thought it's nice to have in the final concert a big piece that doesn't take the whole second half, because there's some business we have to do during that final concert, which is to thank the musicians, thank the parents, thank the staff and the board, and then to play an hour-long piece or a 35-minute piece after that is a bit much. So this symphony that we're closing with on Sunday is about 20 to 23 minutes, which is a great length, but it's an incredible piece, which I think everyone will enjoy.
Is that the Ruth Gibbs?
Yes.
Oh, okay. What I was going to ask is, it's become kind of a familiar and very welcome tradition. You mix the old with the new, the familiar with the often overlooked in the concert program. And Ruth Gibbs was overlooked for a very long time. Now she's considered one of England's greatest composers. PYP performed the U.S. premiere of her Symphony No. 3 2 years ago. And now you're conducting Symphony No. 2, which she composed in 1945, David, but it was premiered in the U.S. only 7 years ago. And I read it's a symphony with only one movement. It's been described as, quote, the sort of music that just makes everything all right in the world. It heals all wounds. I got to say, that sounds like something we could all use right now.
I'm glad somebody said that. I have to say that every minute we've spent rehearsing it has been joyous for me, and I think for the musicians. It's a beautiful symphony. It has so many wonderful things in it, and it's filled with a young person's enthusiasm and optimism, as it was written in, as you say, 1945. So it was a victory symphony for the English. Unfortunately, they did not hear very much of it until fairly recently. But it doesn't take away from how great it is. The fact that the establishment suppressed her and her music to a great extent during her lifetime is a fact that we'll all have to continue to live with. And I only became aware of this symphony less than 5 years ago, I would say. This was the first piece of hers for orchestra alone that I heard. I heard it on a live stream along with a concerto of hers, and I thought, this is a great symphony, and we must do it. Then I was doing a little homework, and I saw, oh, there's a symphony of hers that hasn't had an American premiere yet, so we'll do that one first, almost sight unseen, in terms of not having heard it. It hadn't been recorded yet, the third, and that was great. I don't know if you came to that concert, Ken.
Oh, I heard that, though. That was the third symphony.
Uh-huh. Yes, and that was great. We all loved that symphony, too. But I think this one says everything that symphony says in 15 fewer minutes or so. It has something for everyone to play, and I can't wait to present it to the public. I hope they will enjoy it as much as we have.
I should mention before we talk about the next piece that you and PYP have been a champion of women composers. I remember we've talked about Lily Boulanger, Amy Beach, Lyra Auerbach, on several occasions, Polina Nazikinskaya, among others, and now Valerie Coleman, who you'll be featuring on this Sunday's program. I want to talk about her piece, Tracing Visions. I looked her up, David. She's a contemporary American poser born in 1970, and she grew up in Kentucky in an inner-city neighborhood, apparently the same neighborhood Muhammad Ali grew up in, though not at the same time. And she's a founding member, and this is the connection with PYP, of the Imani Winds Wind Quintet, and they accompanied you and the orchestra for your spring concert last season. Did that collaboration inspire you to perform one of her compositions?
Indirectly. Valerie is no longer with the quintet. She's a composition faculty member of the Juilliard School. But I knew all of them as the quintet was being formed in New York, because I was there at the time.
And you knew Jeff Scott, right?
Jeff and Monica and I and Toy and were closer than I was with the others. But I got to know Valerie, and as she became a composer through that quintet, they needed new music because there wasn't enough things that they wanted to play that existed. That launched her career. And then I saw her more than once with Chamber Music Northwest as the Imanis visited here. And also her compositions for other combinations of instruments were played at Chamber Music Northwest, and they were terrific, as you would expect. So I knew I wanted to do a piece of hers. Our conservatory orchestra did one of her orchestral works a few years ago that had been premiered by the Philadelphia Orchestra. And I was looking for something for this program for string orchestra, as I liked often to feature the strings on a program and give the winds a chance to rest a little bit so they can come out strong to finish the concert. And I saw that she had very recently written this work, and it seemed like a real challenge. And turns out it has been a remarkable challenge. It's a very difficult piece. It was written for very outstanding professional orchestras to play. And I'm just thrilled that we get to play one of Valerie's pieces and have her hear our orchestra, you know, go after all the challenges of her piece, which are technical and organizational, as well as the language in which she's written it is something that some of our musicians will not have encountered before.
And what a story behind it. It's two movements, Till and Amandla. And the Till refers to Emmett Till, who is a 14-year-old African-American who was lynched in Mississippi in 1955. And it also covers the children who were killed in the Uvalde school shooting in 2022. Sets a lot of tragedy for one movement. But the second movement is a little more upbeat. That's Amandla, which is the Zulu word for power. So I think it celebrates the power of a unified people.
Yes, the movements are quite divergent from each other. All of the musicians in our program, I'm sure, know about Uvalde. They can hardly not be aware of that and other tragedies, but they didn't know who Emmett Till was. So I think it's important for them to understand. It's hard to talk about, really, especially in the climate in which we exist, the whole atmosphere around this murder and the mother having the casket open so the world could see what had happened in Mississippi and what that looked like. That's pretty rough stuff. And it's in the music. The music is still beautiful, but there's pain in it. And then the second movement, which is quite joyous, but contains a lot of African drumming rhythms, which are things we talk about and trained to play, but executing them against counterpoint in different rhythms is a very big challenge.
Now, Hanson, you started playing piano at the age of 5. I heard that your dad, who's also a musician, was your inspiration.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I started playing, as you said, when I was 5, 5 and a half-ish. And my dad was, as you said, like part of the reason I got into it. I remember as a little kid, he would play and sing things on the piano, lots of pieces. There's a favorite of his at the time, I think, was And So It Goes by Billy Joel.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, beautiful, beautiful song. And he's a pretty good singer, too. I remember as a kid, I would just listen to that. And I'd just be so captivated, and I wanted to be able to do it myself. So when they suggested piano lessons, I was really eager. I really just went straight for it. I wanted to be able to do what he did and, you know, pull the heartstrings like that.
He wasn't playing classical, obviously, Billy Joel, but you started, when you started taking lessons, that's when you started playing classical piano?
Yeah, so it started with my first teacher, actually my first long-term teacher taught me semi-classical stuff, and eventually we got to my second teacher. Actually, I would say she was my main, my first long-term teacher. Her name was Mimi Shen, and she taught me classical. I'm not sure if it was ever a conscious decision to go into classical, but that's how it went. And I remember, actually, I had gone to a recital for this teacher before I went to her, and I remember seeing her oldest student at the time was a kid named William, and he played, I think it was the Chopin Revolutionary Etude, and I saw that, and I was just, 6-year-old me or 7-year-old me was blown away. It was just phenomenal. I was surprised a human was capable of that, plus someone like 14 at the time, so that actually, I think, was the thing that probably sold me on classical. I wanted to be able to do what William did.
And now you're soloist this Sunday on Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 2. And I looked it up, Hanson. It's been called, quote, an uncharacteristically cheerful piece for Shostakovich. Is that what appealed to you about it?
I would say prior to this, I actually hadn't known much about Shostakovich, so I couldn't speak all that much to whether or not it was characterly Shostakovich or not. But I remember what it appealed to me was just the very happy, playful nature of this piece. I think after, you know, talking to Dave and such, I've gathered that it was a graduation piece for his son. And it's got a lot of, it feels like a lot of that, you know, father-son playful banter in the piece. You can see in there, there's references to Hannon exercises, and overall, it's just a, it almost sounds William Tell-esque at spots as well. So it's just really fun, and that was one of the big appeals to me. And then on top of all of that, you have the middle movement, which I've now learned is also uncharacteristically Shostakovich, very, very tonal, very beautiful.
David, the final work on Sunday's program is Yoda's Theme by John Williams. And I think that's a nod to the date, May the 4th.
That's correct. As soon as they said May the 4th, I knew we had to do something from Star Wars. And I had done Yoda's Theme with our Portland Youth Wind Ensemble when I conducted it a number of years ago. And I knew it was short and extraordinarily beautiful. And I had just seen John Williams conduct it on YouTube. He's, you know, done this tour recently with some of the world's great orchestras conducting his film scores, Berlin, Vienna, Cleveland. I've enjoyed watching those so much. We all have associations with John Williams from seeing the movies and understanding his unique talent, one of the great American voices. But seeing the players of the greatest orchestras in the world having the same reaction because they grew up with the movies before they became musicians, and they have great reverence for this incredible American artist, and just they're so great to play. They fit the instruments well. They're exciting, and it's great to be a part of a sound that you've thought a lot about for most of your life. You know, it's a gift to the audience. It's a gift to the musicians. They love playing it too. So, and I think we'll continue to do more of John Williams' music, both with the Alumni Orchestra at Christmas and other things as we go through the years, because it's just it celebrates America. You know, we have our 250th anniversary of the country coming up, so we'll have to keep including these works of his.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, and Hanson Barrett, the soloist on Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 2, sure to be a highlight of PYP's season-closing concert. The orchestra will be performing one show only this Sunday, May 4th, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, starting at 4 p.m. You can find out more online and purchase tickets in advance at PortlandYouthPhil.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOOS News In Depth.
KBO of Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts